I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A meeting of international donors opened in Berlin this morning with a call to provide aid to Afghanistan to end the spiral of violence. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is seeking $28 billion to help rebuild his country. The United States has already pledged $1 billion, and Secretary of State Colin Powell is expected to pledge another billion today. Meanwhile, ongoing U.S. military operations in the hunt for al-Qaeda in Afghanistan are already costing $1 billion a month. We're joined by Paul O'Brien of the aid agency CARE. He's normally based in Kabul, but today he's at the donors' conference in Berlin. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Robin.
Hamid Karzai is asking for $28 billion. Is it likely he's going to get it at this meeting?
We don't think so. What they're asking for is a multi-year commitment over 7 years so that they would be able to plan with enough predictability and essentially take over control of the reconstruction process in Afghanistan. Early signs that we're hearing here is that the commitments are only going to be for a limited number of years and for significantly less than the $28 billion that he's asking for.
Right. Well, let's look at what the money is needed for. From your vantage point on the ground with CARE, what would be your number one priority for Afghanistan?
Well, it continues to be security. The international community has to help create the security environment in which reconstruction can move forward. Overwhelmingly, the attention to security has gone towards removing the threat of al-Qaeda and the Taliban and the anti-government forces that want to overthrow the Karzai regime. What it's largely ignored is all of the other security threats that are turning Afghanistan into something of a narco-mafia state. Warlords continue to rule through the gun in much of the countryside. Drug lords have every incentive to work with those warlords to make sure that the central government remains weak.
So, Paul, would some of the money needed be to, for instance, train poppy growers to have other jobs?
Well, yes, absolutely. Poppy growers have to have very serious alternative livelihoods if they're going to give up what they see now as the only path out of poverty. But it can't just be about incentives. There has to be the threat of the rule of law with respect to the drug problem. And that's where the international community has largely failed. International forces on the ground will not deal with the drug problem. They've refused to do so.
Does Afghanistan now need the money or more soldiers? The U.S. is planning to send 2,000 more Marines to Afghanistan.
To be honest, it doesn't need more soldiers. It needs soldiers to be doing the right things. It needs soldiers to be providing security for ordinary Afghans and addressing the threats that ordinary Afghans perceive on the ground. Because if ordinary Afghans don't feel secure, they become much more likely to provide the breeding ground for militant extremists. And that's exactly what we tried to avoid when we set out on this journey post 9/11.
We also understand that money's needed to build hospitals, rebuild schools, roads. There's a huge road project ongoing. But in the long run, Afghanistan needs a functioning economy. Is there an economy there now?
Well, it's very hard to speak about the whole of the country as describing one reality. I live in Kabul with my family. There is a vibrant economy in Kabul. It's a safe place. There's an international security assistance force protecting people there. And Afghans are voting with their wallets and with their feet by coming back from places like Pakistan. And Kabul is basically booming. But you're seeing very little economic activity in many parts of the south and the southeast of the country and other areas where people feel that the rule of law is simply inadequate to take the chance on investing with their livelihoods in these places.
Paul, before we let you go, other pressing issues that you feel Americans should know about?
Well, I think that one of the dangers in Afghanistan, because Iraq has proved itself to be increasingly problematic, is that the international community feels such pressure for success in Afghanistan that they will prematurely declare victory. There is a long way to go in Afghanistan. It's still the fact that 6 out of 10 girls in Afghanistan have never seen the inside of a schoolroom. Of course, it's going to take time, but there's a real danger in prematurely declaring victory in Afghanistan because the international community needs to tell a success story. That would be a tragic opportunity lost for Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Paul O'Brien, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Paul O'Brien is with the NGO CARE. He's normally stationed in Afghanistan, but he spoke to us today from the Donors Conference in Berlin.
In mid-March, news flashed around the world that Pakistani troops might have cornered a mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, Ayman al-Zawahiri. He's usually referred to as al-Qaeda's second-in-command, though most intelligence experts consider him the group's number one strategist. But the huge military operation in Pakistan's Waziristan province did not turn up Zawahiri or any other al-Qaeda leader. Reporter Masood Ansari has been covering the raid in Waziristan, and he joins us now from Karachi, Pakistan. Welcome, Masood.
Thank you.
Masoud, what kind of a battle was this? Over here, we heard of an enormous military operation, which seemed to be making tremendous progress for a period of time, and then it kind of went off the headlines. What really happened in Waziristan province?
Well, I mean, you know, there were a couple of villages which they surrounded, which is not that easy because the other party was equally armed. So it was not very easy for the army to enter into, to carry out house-to-house search.
The Pakistani army's been accused of moving without sufficient intelligence in this operation. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is true, frankly, because even on the end of the day, they found out that there are tunnels and these militants could run away from these tunnels, which shows that there was no homework done. Even like if there was intelligence, you should know that like there is a tunnel and you could main it so that nobody could escape. And the only person which they have confirmed is Uzbek and believed to be number 10 in Al-Qaeda ranking. He was there, but they're saying that he's injured and he ran away.
That number 10 of Al-Qaeda may have been there. What about Ayman al-Zawahiri? Is it believed that he was there or not?
Yeah, I'm convinced that he was not there. As far as my sources, even in Taliban and these other militant groups is concerned, I mean, you know, they said like they don't know where he is, but they can tell for, you know, sort of 100% that he was not there.
Now, I want to ask you, in your piece in the New Republic, you write that intelligence officials say the CIA discovered al-Zawahiri was hiding in Waziristan long ago, but they sat on the information. Masoud, why would they do that?
Well, frankly, I mean, it was, number one, the harsh weather, number one. Number two, they were expecting that since al-Zawahiri is there, this bin Laden, he might come and just meet him so that, you know, both of them could be trapped, either could be bound off or maybe arrested alive.
Why didn't the Pakistanis wait till the better weather in the summer? You're dealing with mountains still cloaked in winter.
The one reason was that they found out that some of the militants who were involved into second assassination attempt of Musharraf, it was planned in this area. So that was the reason they thought that they should go and just clean this area of these militants.
Yeah, yeah. You write about, in the New Republic, Pakistani troops using local people as human shields. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, what happened was, you know, after they, there was a resistance from these militants. And, initially there were reports that some 20 soldiers, they were killed. So, I mean, it was very difficult for them to stay in an open area. They didn't have any choice except to seek shelter in the rooftops of some of the villages where, I mean, they know that the militants, they would never ambush them once they are using their local people as human shields. So this is what they did, just to save their lives.
Finally, Masoud, what effect do you think the outcome of this big operation will have on future operations against militants in these tribal areas where so many people are sympathetic to the militants?
Well, I mean, you know, it would always be tough because, there's a lot of people, they are obviously, I mean, sympathetic to these militants because they have worked together throughout these 20, 30 years. This is number one. Number two, the people in this area are heavily armed. So it would always be tough, whether like you do it today or after 20 days.
Masoud Ansari, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Masoud Ansari is a senior reporter for the Pakistani magazine Newsline. His story, Runaround, is in the online edition of The New Republic. He spoke to us from Karachi, Pakistan. The International Court of Justice at The Hague ruled this morning against the United States and in favor of Mexico in ordering the U.S. to review 51 cases of Mexicans on American death rows. Joining us on the line from the Netherlands is Geraldine Coughlin of the BBC. Welcome, Geraldine.
Hello, Bill.
Geraldine, what did the International Court of Justice base its ruling on?
They based its ruling on the 1963 Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. That's the treaty that's at the heart of this case. Mexico brought the case about a year ago, claiming that the US had breached its obligations under this convention. Both countries had signed the treaty, and they argued that the Mexican prisoners were not fully informed of their rights to Mexican consular assistance in the US when they were arrested. American lawyers, on the other hand, argued that this was a publicity stunt and that Mexico was taking the case to court just to challenge its sovereignty over its criminal justice system because Mexico doesn't agree with the death penalty.
Now, what does review the cases mean?
Well, that's a good question. It's still unclear what form these reviews will take. The court actually rejected Mexico's claim that all 52 Mexican prisoners on death row within this case should be annulled. And they said that one prisoner had waived his rights to consular assistance, so the court accepted that he shouldn't be included in the 51 reviews. But the court did leave it up to the United States to decide actually what form these reviews and reconsiderations, they were the terms used, should take.
Now, the International Court of Justice, of course, is the UN's highest judicial body. It certainly doesn't have the power to reverse court decisions in the United States, right?
No, but it is, as you say, the UN's highest judicial organ, and its rulings are legally binding. However, the court doesn't have any means of enforcement, so the United States is morally and legally obliged to honour the court's ruling. If it doesn't, then Mexico can take the case further to the UN Security Council.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. specifically warned the court against trying to turn itself into a criminal appeals court. What's the U.S. argument been throughout this?
Well, throughout, it's been basically rejecting all of Mexico's assertions. They're saying that the U.S. has the right to operate its own criminal justice system the way it wants, and that if it wants to apply the death penalty, that's entirely up to the United States. It says that nobody, not even the World Court, has a right to interfere in the U.S. justice system, and if that there are any changes to be made or any reviews, then that should be up to the United States to decide. But the court overruled that and said, no, we're the highest legal body, and we have to tell you to look again at these cases.
Well, if the U.S. doesn't respect or honor what the court says, why is the U.S. at The Hague at all even arguing its case?
Because they're morally obliged to be there. They're a member of the UN. The court is actually an umbrella body for all UN members. And its actual mandate is to rule on contentious cases between states. So when Mexico brought this case, there was little else that the US could do but comply with the court's procedures and actually send its lawyers to be present.
Geraldine Coughlin of the BBC joined us from the Netherlands. Thanks, Geraldine.
Thanks, Bill.
Just ahead, there's no business like politics. Showbiz and politics have long been co-stars.
And later in the show, who's to blame for rising gas prices? The candidates for president are pointing at each other.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's here and now.
Well, just to cite two recent examples, whether it's Democratic presidential hopeful John Kerry appearing on MTV to express his fascination with rap, or a muscle-bound Republican superstar muscling his way into the governorship of California, showbiz and politics have long mixed. A history chronicled in the new book, Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House. Author Alan Schroeder is a professor of journalism at Northeastern University. He joins us in the studio. Alan, welcome.
Thank you.
Professor, first question, how celebrity took over the White House? What do you mean?
Well, I mean that the ethos of show business has really infused itself into the White House in a number of different ways. You know, you can look at the president almost as a performer, that he's surrounded by makeup people and hairstylists and coaches and all of these things that we would have associated with film actors, with movie stars. So there's that aspect of it. There's also the aspect of presidents seeking out the company of entertainers for various reasons. And so this notion of show business and the White House in league with each other is something that's been growing over the decades. decades and I think exists on different levels.
Growing since when? Because certainly in your book, you're talking about Woodrow Wilson and others way back with a certain connection to the entertainment world.
Yeah, that's right. My kind of first anecdote that I came up with was Woodrow Wilson being visited in Washington by Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin. They came in to do a war bond drive for the president. And they created a sensation in Washington. They were swamped everywhere they went. And so I think that's what really got it going, in the sense that politicians began to recognize the power of these people as icons and began wondering how could they tap into them.
And it was FDR who really got it going.
Yeah, and he was a great movie fan. He loved the movies. In fact, in the 1920s, he wrote a screenplay. It was never produced, but he wrote a screenplay about John Paul Jones, and he loved movie stars. He loved everything about it. But it's interesting about him because he tapped into the show business community for raising funds for his pet cause, which was infantile paralysis. And I think that got him sort of attuned to the notion of these people as draws, as ways to focus attention on him and on politics and on his reelection ultimately.
And it can be, of course, a way to enhance your image. In your book, you mention Jimmy Carter getting John Wayne to the White House. Now, why does a politician like Jimmy Carter want a figure like John Wayne to stand beside him?
Well, John Wayne, in effect, was almost a political figure in his own right, with a constituency, with a sort of power base, who stood for these virtues that Carter must have deemed lacking in himself. And it's interesting because you would never put those two together, and yet John Wayne became influential in the Panama Canal Treaty debate, of all things, and he was on Jimmy Carter's side and basically did great favors to Carter, and Carter was the first to acknowledge it, getting that controversial treaty passed.
What is the downside for a politician to associate with celebrities? There are a number of anecdotes in the book where it didn't work out so well.
Yeah, there are a lot of dangers involved. For one thing, you can appear frivolous. And I think we can look at the example of Bill Clinton early in his presidency. He was hanging out with so many movie stars and so many entertainers that it began to look almost foolish on his part. I think there's that aspect. Entertainers are not held to the same standards as politicians are. So when they're out on the campaign trail, sometimes they do and say things that aren't politic, if we can use that word. Just this past year, we had Michael Moore appearing with Wesley Clark in New Hampshire, making the charge that George W. Bush was a deserter. Wesley Clark stood by, did not attempt to make a correction on that at all, and it became an issue for him that he had to deal with several critical days in that campaign. So they mingle somewhat at their own peril with entertainers.
At their own risk. You know, you mentioned the Clinton White House, which did seem at times to be engulfed by celebrities. But interestingly, the man who followed Clinton, a very different president, insofar as the entertainment industry goes, you're right, George W. Bush is perhaps the least culturally attuned chief executive in modern history. What do you mean?
I mean that he has no interest in show business. He likes comedies and comedy films, but that's about it. Basically, he's a sports guy. He's not an entertainment guy. He has had fewer contacts with entertainers, both in his campaign phase and during his presidency, probably than any modern president, you know, of our time. He was asked questions during the campaign. He was asked, for instance, about the movie Titanic. He'd never heard of it. He didn't know any of this stuff that is common currency in a lot of lives. And I would make the point that, I don't want to overstate this, but I think for presidents, their ability to relate to the pop culture or have an appreciation for it is something that connects them with ordinary voters. And to not have that, it's almost like there's a piece of your Americanness that's missing if you're clueless about the pop culture and what people are interested in.
Although for a lot of Bush supporters, no doubt, the entertainment industry being as smarmy and sleazy as it can be, they may understand perfectly well why he doesn't want to have much to do with it.
That's true. Hollywood has always been a bit of a whipping boy for the right. Clearly, over the years, beginning with Franklin Roosevelt, the entertainment industry, has been kind of a wholly owned subsidiary of the Democratic Party. And so the Republicans can kind of use that as a point of criticism. But there again, I think they have to be a little careful about that, because a lot of people love a lot of different performers for various reasons. And if you demonize these people, I think that runs the risk of backfiring on you.
How much at the end of the day do you think it matters whether a president has the support of the entertainment community insofar as getting elected?
in so much as entertainment money buys advertising, which unfortunately is the way people get elected in this country, I think it does matter. And I think there's a psychic connection that you can make. I would argue that Bill Clinton in 1992 was sort of ratified as a celebrity by other celebrities because they accepted him and made him one of their own. And that was at a point where he was not the household name that he later became. So I think that the big stars can confer a little of their magic on candidates in a positive way.
And in our ever more celebrity-obsessed culture, we can expect this to be around presidential politics for the foreseeable future.
I think so. I mean, if it goes back 100 years, and I think if we were to project 100 years into the future, I would not be surprised if it was still going on.
Alan, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Alan Schroeder is author of the new book, Celebrity in Chief, How Show Business Took Over the White House.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright about religion and politics and the 9/11 Commission.
And best-selling Tom Perata is out with his new novel, Little Children. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
OPEC ministers meeting in Vienna today say they will cut production of crude oil by 4%. The move comes as the price of a barrel of crude creeps toward the $40 mark and as U.S. consumers are paying record prices for gasoline. Peter Kemp is editor of Petroleum Intelligence Weekly in London. Welcome, Peter.
Hi there, Bill.
Peter, prices are very high, and OPEC knows that keeping oil prices reasonably low is good for the world economy, doesn't it? And when economies are healthy, they consume more oil. So why would OPEC cut supply and risk raising prices?
Well, it may seem counterintuitive for them to be announcing a coming cut in supply when oil prices are so high. But in a way, it's a preemptive strike. It's anticipatory, because we're now moving into the second quarter of the year. We're swinging between the winter heating oil season and the coming summer gasoline season. And historically, OPEC knows that oil demand is heads down during this period, and they're trying to anticipate that by taking a few barrels of oil off the market to support prices. They're not happy that prices are so high, but they're fearful that if they supply too much oil, they could crash with a wallop and go way down to single digits very, very quickly.
OPEC must play quite a guessing game almost all the time, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, they watch the data that's collected by international agencies, including elements of the United States government, to give them a reading of the fundamental situation as regards oil demand and oil supply. And those numbers are telling them and anybody who wants to look at them closely that there is technically plenty of oil out there. And it's the futures market which seems to be driving prices up to these almost unprecedented levels.
So if there's plenty of oil out there, even geopolitically, given all the shocks that the world economy has experienced, war in Iraq and so on, isn't there an argument from the psychological perspective that OPEC might want to not look like they're trying to raise prices?
Well, indeed, you've got a fair point there, and they are sort of talking at several levels here. They're saying that they're going to stick to their guns and restrain supply a little during the second quarter. But they're also saying, we will leak barrels, we will provide barrels to any of our customers who asks for them. And they've been doing that over recent months, in that there is a big gap between the official quota, which they say they're abiding by, and the observed supply that they're putting into the market.
So when an American consumer goes to fill his or her tank and is shocked by the price and wants to blame someone, who do they blame?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, obviously, they're hearing that OPEC is tightening the taps, and you can see prices at the gas pump going up. But that is more to do with local problems, domestic problems in the United States this year, with these very complicated formulas for reformulated gasoline, and also the switchover you've had in some markets due to local legislation from the use of MTBE to ethanol. And it's a shortage in some areas of gasoline that's driving up prices, rather than a basic shortage of crude supply.
So, Peter, you mean the American consumer experiencing sticker shock with gas prices can't even have the satisfaction of pointing a finger in one simple direction?
Well, as I say, it's not as if American refiners are to blame and suppliers of crude are blameless in this. We've also got a very nervous global situation, to which you referred to earlier, with terror attacks here and there and a general sense that things aren't going very well in the world right now. And that's always bad news for oil markets.
Peter Kemp is editor of Petroleum Intelligence Weekly. He joined us from London. Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, the soaring gas prices are fueling hostile jabs and heated debate between presidential hopeful John Kerry and incumbent President George W. Bush. Kerry charges that Bush is responsible for the high prices and that the president is sacrificing the environment to boost industry. Bush, for his part, says Kerry would support new gas taxes. Here's the latest Bush campaign ad.
Some people have wacky ideas, like taxing gasoline more so people drive less. That's John Kerry. He supported a 50-cent a gallon gas tax. If Kerry's gas tax increase were law, the average family would pay $657 more a year. Raising taxes.
Jody Wilgorin is covering the issue for the New York Times. Jody, John Kerry said in California yesterday that the administration should stop filling the strategic petroleum reserves. And he also said the U.S. should be putting more pressure on OPEC to increase supplies. We just heard an analyst say that's not the real problem. Your take on John Kerry, Stan?
Well, for John Kerry, obviously, he wants to use anything that's going on in the news to make his case against President Bush. And I think he saw rising fuel prices as a great opportunity to hit the administration on an issue that voters really understand.
Isn't it also true that administrations traditionally talk to OPEC ministers in private? In fact, some are saying that OPEC might have cut its output, except it didn't want to be seen as kowtowing to the Bush administration. So wouldn't John Kerry know that?
You know, there's a little bit of a different responsibility for an incumbent versus a challenging candidate. Obviously, with anything to do with oil policy or gas prices, everything that the leader of the free world would say or do might have major impact on the market, and it's always a dicey thing politically for a candidate or an incumbent to say or do something that would make a market fluctuate. I think John Kerry, you know, feels like he's outside of it a little bit and can really use the news to make his case.
Well, President Bush, on the other hand, as we just heard, is going to accuse John Kerry of supporting gas tax increases. John Kerry's denying that. So what has been John Kerry's history when it comes to the gas tax?
John Kerry had said that he might support a 50-cent tax increase back in 93. That tax never passed. He didn't vote for it. In fact, people in the Bush administration also have expressed support for such a tax, including their chief economist. As for the votes, the 11 votes that the Bush ad references, John Kerry did vote for various large omnibus budget bills that did include some small increases in federal gas taxes. But it is slightly misleading to characterize those as, you know, votes for higher gas taxes.
John Kerry also saying that Dick Cheney should reveal who the oil executives were who met with him in secret to set the oil policy of the U.S. Of course, that's an issue floating around. Who's going to look better here, Jody, as you and others watch from the sideline? Is there a chance that making gas prices part of an election year campaign is going to backfire on one of these candidates?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I think the oil executives line really does symbolize what John Kerry's trying to do here. That's one of the hot issues for Democrats. They, you know, feel like this is a symbol of everything that's wrong with the administration. They're rich oil men, and they're giving deals to their friends from Halliburton and other companies. The truth is, though, that gas prices go up every summer, typically, and then they usually go down again, and we're 7 months out from the election, and it's kind of unlikely that this will have much of an impact down the road in November.
Jody Wilgorin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Jody Wilgorin with The New York Times.
Still to come, has the world learned a lesson from the Rwandan genocide of 10 years ago?
You're listening to Here and Now. Alistair Cook died this week. The British-born journalist was best known in the U.S. as the face of masterpiece theater on public television, and listeners around the world waited weekly for him to deliver his Letter from America on the BBC World Service. Letter from America debuted in 1946 and continued nearly without interruption until just last month. Almost 3,000 letters that Alistair Cook described early on as weekly missives to a Briton by the fireside about the springs of American life. Cook himself became an American citizen in 1941. He wrote extensively about American history. His contributions to this country were recognized when he was invited to address a joint session of Congress. And Bill Littlefield, host of the WBUR-produced sports program Only a Game, has this further appreciation.
Alistair Cook has been celebrated as a wonderful broadcaster, and so he was. He was also an elegant writer. 9 years ago, I had the opportunity to interview him about a collection of his writings that had to do with sports, among other things. The book is called Fun and Games. Mr. Cook was kind enough to read, for Only a Game, an excerpt from an essay he wrote 50 years ago about a cricket game between Yale and Harvard.
But after all, it's not the winning that matters, is it? It's, to coin a word, the amenities that count. The smell of the dandelions, the puff of the pipe, the click of the bat when Harvard's batting, the rain on the neck, the chill down the spine, the slow, exquisite coming on of sunset and dinner and rheumatism.
Alistair Cook and I spoke in his hotel room. He was extraordinarily gracious, and his memory was remarkable. He recalled soccer games he'd played in as a schoolboy, and he spoke self-deprecatingly of his bias toward athletes who made mastery of their difficult games look easy. My admiration for Alistair Cook was in part based on how easy he made precision and wit seem when he wrote, and on how thoroughly he seemed to be relishing not only the challenges of writing, but what had to be the chore of talking about what he'd written. Toward the end of our conversation, I brought up the Sesame Street character Cookie Monster. Mr. Cook's eyes shone. It turns out that the master monster maker, Jim Henson, had asked Mr. Cook's permission to appropriate his name for Alistair Cookie, who would give the Cookie Monster himself an opportunity to host Monsterpiece Theater. Mr. Cook was thrilled with the idea and with the perks of its execution.
I go in airports, and little girls hiding behind their mother's skirts suddenly see me and giggle and ask their mother, and the mother says, yes, go ahead, ask him. And they come up to me and say, are you Mr. Cookie, the Cookie Monster? I said, absolutely. And they run for their lives. So I said, 80 years from now, when nobody's ever heard of Masterpiece Theatre or John Gielgud, they'll remember the Cookie Monster. And they met him in the flesh. See, so I was delighted.
Alistair Cook's death on Monday deprived us of an enthusiastic sports fan, a terrific writer, and a fellow who knew not to take himself too seriously. A man who seemed to know not only how to enjoy himself thoroughly, but how to convey that joy on the page or in conversation with uncommon style and grace.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Alistair Cook died Monday night at his home in Manhattan. He was 95 years old.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's here and now.
In just 100 days, 10 years ago, next week, a beautiful green country of rolling hills, Rwanda, became a killing ground. Hutus killed an estimated 800,000 people, mostly of the Tutsi minority population, and mostly not with guns, but with machetes. The UN force commander in Rwanda then was General Romeo Dallaire.
Lots of those eyes still haunt me. Angry eyes or innocent eyes. No laughing eyes. But the worst eyes that haunt me are the eyes of those people who are totally bewildered. They're looking at me with my blue beret and they're saying, what in the hell happened? We were moving towards peace. You were there as the guarantor, you know, their interpretation of the mandate. How come I'm dying here? And they're absolutely right.
Rwanda's agony back then and the world's indifference to it are re-examined in a new documentary, Ghosts of Rwanda. And producer Greg Barker joins us in the studio. Greg, welcome.
Thanks, Bill. It's good to be here.
Greg, thanks for joining us. To start, Rwanda had been at peace in 1994. UN troops came to monitor the peace. Hope was in the air. And then the Hutu prime minister of Rwanda was killed in a plane crash. How long after that did the killing start?
Immediately. That night. That night, roadblocks went up around the city. By the morning, they started systematically killing moderates, both moderate Hutus and also Tutsis in Kigali.
No one ever found out who killed the prime minister.
Who shot down the plane is one of the biggest mysteries of all of this. But regardless, the genocide happened, and whoever did it, it knew that they were setting a light to a fire.
How equipped was the UN delegation to deal with the slaughter as it then began?
Not at all. I mean, it's important to remember that the peacekeeping mission there was going to keep the peace. It was never, ever designed to deal with a crisis like this. But having said that, once it began, they were just undercut by their own institution systematically. So troops were pulled out. They didn't have anything. They didn't have spare parts for their vehicles. They ended up with only three working armored personnel carriers.
Up against tens of thousands of Rwandan troops.
Up against another Holocaust.
And then 10 Belgian peacekeepers killed.
Yes. Remember, this happened 6 months after Mogadishu, after 18 Americans were killed on a UN peacekeeping mission in Somalia, which created an uproar both in the in the U.S., but also for the UN as an institution. And the thing about Rwanda is the planners of the genocide, the Hutu extremists who conceived it and carried it out, did not want a UN presence in Rwanda when the killing began, and they targeted Belgian peacekeepers to frighten the UN into withdrawal, echoing Somalia, which is exactly what happened. You know, you asked how quickly the killing began. It began the night of the plane crash. That same night, Dallaire called UN headquarters, the peacekeeping department, then run by Kofi Annan, and asked for guidance, for instructions. And he was told, under no circumstances should UN forces get involved. Under no circumstances should UN forces try to save Rwandan lives. They were ordered to literally do nothing. And then when they were told to do something, they were told to rescue the Westerners, the expatriates in Kigali, and get them out. And their hands were tied.
Let's hear a bit from Kofi Annan from the documentary.
When it will get to everybody how dangerous the situation is, the killings that were going on were about to happen, and we couldn't get the troops, we couldn't get the governments to move. For me, that was the most incomprehensible. Shouldn't the fact that the killing was taking place and we knew and we were sending planes to remove others to safety moved us to act?
Greg, why didn't the world act? Kofi Annan's just explained that countries didn't want to commit troops to this. Why not?
There really is no answer to that. I mean, there's all sorts of practical reasons they didn't act. They didn't act.
Somalia.
They didn't act because of Somalia. They didn't act because Rwanda is a tiny country in the middle of Africa that no one's ever heard of. And there wasn't in anyone's national interest. It's also important to remember that the killing happened very quickly. So by the time senior policymakers at the UN and in Washington actually began to focus on it, a lot of the killing had already happened. But even when they did focus on it, they still didn't want to do anything. What's also extraordinary and has come out in just the making of this film is that there were UN soldiers who just decided to ignore those orders and do the right thing. One in particular, a Senegalese captain, a young guy, grew up in the slums of Dakar in Senegal, who instinctively decided on the very first day that he was going to save lives. He saves hundreds of lives. His name was Captain Mbaye Jang, and he became a hero to the other UN forces there.
The killing went on and on, Greg, at a phenomenal rate. At one point, General Romeo Dallaire decided to try to negotiate with some of the killers. Let's listen.
All of a sudden, something happened that turned them into non-human things. And I was not talking with humans. I literally was talking with evil. It even became a very difficult ethical problem. Do I actually negotiate with the devil to save people? Or do I wipe it out? I shoot the bastards right there. I haven't answered that question yet.
Meanwhile, while this is going on, back in Washington, they're parsing the word genocide, aren't they? Tell me about that.
This is one of the most extraordinary aspects of all of this. There was a decision made within the White House and within the State Department that the administration could not call this a genocide because there's a UN genocide convention that America had ratified. That requires states to take some action to stop genocide. It doesn't require military action, but it requires action. And they felt like they would either be bound by this convention or, in a more general sense, if they called it a genocide, they would be bound by public opinion to do something. First, they didn't want to use it at all, and they said, well, maybe acts of genocide have occurred, but what's an act of genocide? And how many, one of the famous questions was, put to the State Department spokesperson, how many acts of genocide does it take to make a genocide? And her answer was a complete bureaucratic gobbledygook.
There are formulations that we are using that we are trying to be consistent in our use of. I don't have an absolute categorical prescription against something, but I have the definitions, I have phraseology, which has been...
Greg, having lived with this, as you have, how do you deal with evil? Is evil only to be answered with force?
I wish I had a straight answer to that. I think, everyone who was there uses that term, evil. They all talk about it. They talk about the look in the killer's eyes. They all go back to the eyes. You could see it, some dark corner of the human soul that came out, was unleashed like looking into the abyss, like looking into hell. What do you do when that happens? When the worst side of humanity comes out, do you try to fight it? Well, you fight it, you might get killed. Do you negotiate with it? But will that ever work? And how do you even morally contemplate talking to evil? But people did. For me, the big lesson of Rwanda is, look, you can't stop everything like this. But the great tragedy was that everyone just left. Except for a handful of people, the world left and didn't want to know. The people who stayed, the handful, the few who stayed behind, made an enormous difference. The UN and the Red Cross saved tens of thousands of lives, combined probably up to 80,000 lives, just by being there and facing evil and saying, no, you can't do this. And that's the great lesson. That's the great question, I think, that I hope people can take away from this, is that you have to ask yourself. I have to ask myself. We all do. What would we do in the face of evil? And you can take lessons from people who had the strength of character to face it down.
Greg, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Producer Greg Barker's documentary, Ghosts of Rwanda, airs tomorrow night on PBS stations around the country. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here-now. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tomagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Zach Christo. Our intern is Ed Walters.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Rob.